Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour. This is David Corey. I'm an Air Force veteran and a lawyer who represents veterans. I'm here tonight with Richard Hurley. We're lawyers with the Florida law firm of Corey and Hurley Law Group. This is the first broadcast of the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio, and we're pleased you're listening. We're dedicating this radio show to America's veterans. It's a weekly talk and news show. We'll be here every Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, 7 Mountain, and 6 p.m. Pacific Time. And thanks to the Internet, our audience is truly nationwide. We have an exciting program tonight as we discuss the important issue of how to reform and improve the VA, a timely topic as the Trump administration takes office this Friday. Now, this show is about veterans issues, so to all veterans and your families, that really makes this your show. Callers are welcome. Grab a pen and paper. The call-in number for the United States and Canada is 1-888-627-6008. Again, that's 1-888-627-6008. For those of you elsewhere, you can call direct area code 323-744-4831. Again, 323-744-4831. Now over to Richard Hurley, my co-host for this program.
Good evening, David. This is Richard Hurley, and hello to all the listeners out there. I want to wish everyone a happy Martin Luther King Day. For those of you who had an opportunity to take the day off, I hope you had a chance to chill and maybe enjoy a barbecue or something. I'm very excited about our show this year and everything we have planned coming up. I'm looking forward to getting the word out to our veterans and to inform our veterans and the public at large about the true state of affairs at the VA. Hopefully, we will be able to give proper direction for our vets when dealing with the VA. Our experience and tips should be helpful. I want to remind everybody that the call-in number for U.S. and Canada is 1-888-627-6008. David, you and I are knee-deep in all aspects of the VA. While some may cringe with the coming year considering the state of affairs at the VA, I see it as an exciting opportunity to possibly make some positive inroads into a system which is clearly broke. Soon the Senate should confirm Trump's nominee, David Shulkin, as Secretary of the VA. He will be the third such person in the last 8 years, following Eric Shinseki, who resigned as a result of the VA scandal in Arizona, and Bob McDonald, who was ineffective in managing the VA. Simply put, the VA is a mess. David Shulkin brings years of experience while managing hospitals in New Jersey and New York. As a former resident of New Jersey, I wish him luck. However, David, you and I will continue to put pressure on the VA so that our veterans receive the best medical care and also start to receive fair and reasonable disability compensation consistent with their service-connected injuries. Tonight, we are opening the call-in lines to hear all about your experiences with the VA and your ideas on how the VA can improve its health care and benefits program. So, David?
Yes, and as Richard has said, we'll share our experiences with you both tonight and the upcoming weekly broadcast. We represent veterans primarily in disability claims and appeals, and we see on a daily basis how complex and incredibly slow the VA is. You know, ideally, people would think that lawyers shouldn't have to be involved, and there's a lot of truth to that, but the fact is the system has gotten so incredibly complicated, thousands of pages of regulations, thousands of appellate case decisions, it's become an unfortunate necessity. Now, with the incoming Trump administration, as Richard said, that's a good time to be talking about the state of the VA over the last few years. As Richard said, the outgoing secretary is Robert McDonnell. He took over July 30th of 2014 after General Eric Shinseki was forced out after the media coverage of the VA scandals about medical care waiting time and the falsification of wait time statistics. And some veterans actually died waiting for medical care. Now, surprisingly, despite a very mixed record, in our view, Secretary McDonald had actually had some support from some of the major veterans groups to continue as the VA secretary, but President-elect Donald Trump this past week has nominated the current Undersecretary for Health of the Veterans Health Administration, one of the major branches of the VA, Dr. David Shulkin, to serve as the next VA secretary. And I expect he's probably going to be confirmed. He was confirmed about 18 months ago for his present job by the Senate, and I suspect that's probably going to be similar case in the next few weeks. So Richard and I see our job as part of this radio show to basically try to hold the Trump administration and the new incoming secretary accountable for their promises on how to improve the VA. And we certainly welcome our listeners to call in to share their experiences as well as their ideas for how things can be improved, both on the medical side as well as the claims side. Now, some of you may recall that in 2014, whenever the VA scandal erupted and General Shinseki was forced out, Bob McDonnell took over with a lot of fanfare, making all sorts of promises. And I'd like to ask Richard, from his experience, what have been your impressions over the last 2.5 years about that success or really perhaps lack of success, particularly on the claims side?
Well, you know, David, it seems to me over the last 4 or 5 years working with veterans, most of the news, whether it's from the administration, is, you know, or the VA, is about the medical side versus the claims side. It seems like the claims side, I'm not going to say gets ignored, but the fact of the matter is that these claims are not being moved along as quickly as the veteran would like it. I mean, for instance, we have a motto, patience and persistence. And unfortunately, that has to be our motto, because with the VA and dealing with disability claims, you have to be patient and you can't give up. That's why you have to be persistent and you have to keep the ball in play and keep moving forward. But it's pretty sad when you're telling your clients that, you know, it's going to take three, four years before we may have a resolution, a successful resolution to the case.
Right. It really does take a long time. Richard, I'd like to, sorry to interrupt, but I'd like to give an opportunity for our first caller. We have a first caller coming in and asked Doug, our expert there at the headquarters, to bring on our first caller. Hello?
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Yes, I was calling because I was wondering, for a veteran who has 100% permanent total, if he passes not of anything that he was claimed being disabled from, how many years is it that he would need to fulfill on his permanent total before his spouse would get his pension?
That's a good question. I'd have to refer to my law books to double check on that answer, and I'd be happy to do that and get back with you either later or off the air. If you'd like to leave your name and phone number, we'll be happy to get back with you on that. But that is one of the options. The most common scenario that we see has been when the veteran dies because of a service-connected disability, and then it's an issue of either service-connecting that death or proving that was the cause of death. But it is possible in some situations based on the length of time, and I'd be happy to take your name and get back with you with specifics.
All right.
So thank you for calling. Thank you. All right. Doug, any other callers yet? All right, Richard, let's go back to your point about the VA and the claims. I agree with you that that the system is on the claim side particularly is broken. One thing that's interesting is that when Secretary McDonald took over, there was a huge backlog of pending claims, initial claims, and what has happened in the last 2.5 years basically has been that many of those claims have been adjudicated, so the backlog on the claim side has somewhat dissipated. What the VA then did, essentially by decisions that denied service connection or that lowballed ratings, tended to push these cases into the appeal stage, which typically take 2 to 3 years just for the first stage of appeals, and then for the next stage after that, another 2, 3, or even 4 years to get a decision. And so now the backlog on the appeal side, which the VA historically has not tracked for timing, is tremendous, and we see that. Would you agree on that, Richard? What is your sense about perhaps what could be done on the appeals backlog?
Well, you know, we deal primarily with the St. Pete regional office, and there are approximately 900 people that work in that particular building. And of that 900, there are approximately 26 to 30 that handle the appeals. They're called decision review officers. There are probably in excess of 1,000 some odd cases that they each have to deal with. Last time I was down in St. Pete, which about a week ago, I was told that there were 31,000 and give or take a few appeal cases pending. So if you have 30 officers handling these cases, you can see, and even the most well-meaning person working in the office is going to be hard-pressed to be able to handle these cases. So obviously, the VA needs to hire more personnel. You know, we can't keep worrying about the top. We got to start worrying about getting people at the basic level. You know, you should probably have 100 decision review officers rather than 30. That would be a good start.
And that's just at one regional office. When you're speaking of having 30 decision review officers, we're speaking of the regional office that deals with the state of Florida, which is, you know, the one of the largest states as far as veterans population, and extremely busy,
you know,
regional office.
David, the other thing that I get from my clients all the time is that periodically the VA sends out these meaningless, what I call computer-generated letters, which when my clients get them, when our clients get them, it sends them into a tizzy. And it could be something nothing more than your case is still in progress and it's still being processed through the VA. Well, that doesn't tell them anything. Quite frankly, I don't even know why they send these letters out anymore. So, you know, maybe Dr. Shulkin should start looking at revamping just the whole procedure. Why are we sending out these meaningless letters? There's so much secretarial stuff that's being done or not done, that Dr. Shulkin or whoever he's going to assign should start addressing. It just seems like a waste of time and burying people with paper as opposed to doing what the veteran wants, which is to handle their claim. That's all they want. They just want their claims handled. And they don't want to, you know, you hear this, David, you and I hear this all the time. They all say that their VA is waiting for them to die.
Right, right. Well, I think that's actually a legitimate concern because I was reading some statistics just the other day that over about a 5-year period, there are literally tens of thousands of veterans that died while their cases were pending appeal. And the VA will tell us and tell our clients that it's pretty much they'll address the claims or appeals in the order that they're received. They'll make a few exceptions, including if the veteran is literally on his or her deathbed. I've had clients with cancer, ultimately terminal cancer, but they weren't literally on their deathbed, and the VA has not advanced their cases despite our request. They'll also advance based on age. The Board of Veterans' Appeals tends to be a bit better than the regional office in that regard. They will advance a case if the veteran is 75 or older. The St. Pete regional office takes a tougher line than that even. And then the third example or situation where the VA will tend to advance a case on the docket will be if the veteran is essentially on the verge of becoming homeless. It's kind of that extreme of a situation. And keep in mind that for everyone else who don't fit in this category, they may not be on the verge of being homeless or dying, but they could be in dire straits financially or in terms of health, be unemployable, and there they sit with their case taking many, many years to get a hearing, and then sometimes a year or two after that just to get a decision. So, Richard, I agree with you as far as the VA needs to hire more claims and appeals personnel. I think they also have to allocate their resources better, because the St. Petersburg office, as one example, has about 900 employees, and as you pointed out, less than three dozen of them serve as decision review officers. And again, it seems like a poor allocation of personnel that they have so few people that are actually doing the key work in advancing the appeals. But there are other, I think, other things that have to be considered. Go ahead, Richard.
You know, one of the things that, and you know that I've been going down over the last 3 or 4 years, it's kind of like my little spy mission. I go down to the VA and just kind of sit there, and while I'm waiting to be seen by one of the staffers to review a bunch of our cases, you know, I take notice of just the staff there. I mean, the number of coffee breaks that these staffers take. There'll be a room full of veterans. When I say room, we're talking 25, 30 veterans sitting in this room. And there's four or five staffers that are supposed to be tending to these people. And they start at 8:30. One of the staffers will take one of the veterans in, spend that 30 minutes with them. The veteran leaves, and the staffer turns to the receptionist and says, "Well, I'm going on a coffee break now." And off he goes. And about 20 minutes later, he comes back, takes another veteran, finishes up with him, and says, "I'm going on another coffee break." And there's all these veterans sitting around.
Yeah, there's no sense of urgency, really, when you just observe how people function around there.
Yeah. You know, and the veterans, you can see they're getting frustrated and shaking their head. And that leads me to how would you describe the culture, David? I mean, you've been handling VA cases now a lot longer than I have.
What I find ironic about the VA system, because the VA is there to serve the veterans, people, the men and women that have served our country and who need help, medical help, financial help with the disability claims. The military has a certain culture of getting the job done, getting the mission done, of holding people accountable. And it's a fairly well-disciplined organization, the military, all the branches. And what's ironic to me is you take the VA, and many of the VA employees are veterans themselves, and yet the entire culture of the VA is different. And I think it's because of the civil service mentality, which is they're going to do the job at their own pace, and there's really no accountability from Washington, D.C., or any of their regions, because they share that same sort of a mindset of just, for the most part, they're going to do the work at their own speed. There's no sense of urgency, and there's certainly no accountability. Congress passed a law in 2014 to give the new incoming secretary at that time, Bob McDonnell, more power to hold the people accountable who are part of the health care waiting time scandal. And very few people lost their jobs. I think there needs to be, to answer your question about the culture, there needs to be more accountability, and hopefully the new incoming secretary will do that. But it has to come from the top of the organization and all the way down to the people that are dealing with the claims, the customer service people at the regional office, who do not have really that sense of urgency. On paper, the VA has, you know, a great motto, taking care of veterans and their survivors, their family members, and, you know, their core values are great of integrity and caring for people. But when you see it actually in action, it's not, and it's extraordinarily frustrating. Our clients, for the most part, are in financial straits. They're in struggling financially because of their disabilities, and they literally cannot afford to wait 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years for a fair rating. Yeah, maybe the VA may give them a 10% rating. They may get a few hundred dollars a month, but these people may be out of jobs because the VA has essentially lowballed the ratings. So there's a lot that needs to be done. Richard, I'd like to ask you, you know, your thoughts on some of the things that the VA has done already over the last few years to try to speed up the process. They came out with these things called disability benefit questionnaires. Disability benefit questionnaires where the veterans could theoretically take these forms to their doctor, have them fill out these forms. The doctors fill out the forms in order to assess their disability, which the VA would then use, theoretically, to rate their claims. What have been your impressions about the DBQs and really their usefulness?
Well, as you know, David, the DBQs are actually a form that that was prepared by the VA. It's their form. Kind of on a side note, digress a little bit. I've given these DBQs to veterans to take to their healthcare doctors, and they'll tell me, "Well, my healthcare doctor is a VA doctor." I said, "Well, take the DBQ anyway," and they. Veteran comes back and says, well, the healthcare doctor said he wouldn't fill it out. I said, why not? He said, well, we don't do that. I said, did you tell them that it's their form?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know? So that's one of the solutions.
They won't even fill out their own form. But as far as the usefulness goes, I can tell you from the my experience, they've been very helpful, especially if you do get a doctor, usually it's a private doctor, to fill it out and you work with the doctor. I know we use one doctor for post-traumatic stress cases, and he does an excellent job when he prepares that form. And it's really bolstered our veterans' claims when we presented it and had to argue his case. I wanted to talk about, you were talking about the delay. We've had a couple of situations where when we've been at a hearing, and clearly the decision review officer can make a decision. It's the facts and the law and everything is within her purview and her authority to make that decision. I say her because I think 99% of the cases we've had have been with female DROs. And she has said, well, and I use the term punt. She punted and said, well, I can't do that. She goes, you probably should go before the Board of Veteran Appeals, which, David, as you know, means filing another appeal and waiting another 2 years.
Or even longer.
Yet she could have made the decision, but she chose not to. Now, fortunately, you know, we've been able to circumvent that a little bit, but that's kind of the attitude there. I'm not going to make the decision. I'm going to let someone else make the decision, despite the fact that the veteran's going to have to wait another 24 months. That veteran might be very sickly. I mean, David, you know that we do file the motion to expedite a case, but as I've been told, and I'm sure you've been told too, and I was just told this by a decision review officer, unless you're at least 85, unless you've got 1 foot in the grave, and you're about to get bounced from your home, they're not going to expedite your case.
Right. And that the 85 is what we've been hearing from the regional office, 75 from the BVA. Yeah, mm-hmm. So it's not even consistent among the different levels of the VA. But
yeah, and then I've had cases where It gets up before the BVA, and the BVA remands the case back for the regional office to now make a decision. And so now I'm sitting in front of a staffer and saying, well, when are you guys going to make a decision? The BVA sent this case back to you, and they said, you know, it needs to be expedited. And they look at me and they laugh. They said, we're not going to, they don't, one guy said to me, the BVA doesn't understand what we're up against down here. We'll get to it when we can get to it. So getting back to your earlier thought about no accountability. I mean, I know when I was doing criminal and civil and family law, if I ever handled a judge's direct order that way, I'd be up, I'd be in trouble.
Right, right. And you don't see any of that accountability with the VA. In fact, the VA admits that they really don't even track the processing time for appeals. They'll process the initial claims within a certain period of time and tell Congress they're doing a certain percentage within that standard. But for appeals, basically anything goes, and it's incredibly frustrating. We had a case, as you know, that recently resolved where the veteran had to wait a couple years to get a hearing before the decision review officer. We prepared. We used that waiting time to our advantage. We got another expert opinion from a doctor. We prepared other evidence, gathered documentation. So we were well prepared for the hearing. And those not real familiar with the VA process may be thinking, well, okay, it's good. You got the hearing. What was the decision? Well, we had to wait more than a year and a half after that hearing for the decision review officer to actually render a decision. And it's not as if we sat back just waiting for the decision. We were constantly calling, emailing, filing congressional complaints to find out what was holding it up. Never really got an answer other than periodically being told that, you know, this veteran is number such and such in line, you know, and it was in starting in the tens of thousands and eventually dwindling down to his decision was made. And fortunately, it was a very favorable decision. It achieved our major goal, which was to get him to 100% rating. But again, for that long period of time, this veteran was out of work and needed the money. It was very difficult. So I think one thing that we're going to be doing is watching carefully what the incoming administration does to reform the VA, particularly on the appeals side. And we'd like to again invite our callers to call in, share their personal situations, their experiences, and also to offer their ideas of perhaps how the VA could be improved. Again, the call-in number, the toll-free call-in number for those in the United States and Canada is 1-888-627-6008. Again, 1-888-627-6008. So give us a call. This is really your show, and we'd like to hear from you, hear your views, hear your ideas. Richard, some of the other things that we encounter with the VA, in addition to the long waiting time and, you know, the really lack of any sense of urgency, is really the complexity of cases. And how would you evaluate that or compare that to what you saw, let's say, in other areas of the law, and then perhaps share your thoughts on the use of veteran service officers and attorneys?
Well, you know, when you and I started this firm 5 years ago, and I started looking at these cases, I learned very quickly that these cases are as complicated as anything I'd ever handled in the civil or criminal or family law areas. It requires the gathering of extensive evidence and research, both research in terms of the veteran's situation when he was in service and gathering evidence with regard to his service, and also the law. I mean, there's extensive law in the VA area. And it really kind of struck me that at one time the VA system was set up for only the for essentially the veteran to be able to do it himself.
Right.
And that the VA had a duty to assist the veteran. So basically you had a situation, as I saw it, David, where you would, you know, separate from the military, and now you're home. You realize that you've gotten some injuries as a result of your military experience. You go down to your local VA, and you you sign in. They examine you, and, you know, you have a give and take, and the VA turns around and says, yeah, I understand. You hurt your knee. You hurt your back. And, you know, we're going to compensate you just like a workers' comp case.
Right.
However, David, you and I both know that's not the way it works. And unfortunately, today, it's very adversarial.
Right.
And it wasn't set up that way.
Right. And I think one thing you mentioned that's important is that, and because veterans will hear this, that the VA is there to help, which itself should be a red flag. The VA, in the statutes and regulations, has a legal duty to assist the veteran and assist the veteran in terms of telling the veteran what's needed to prevail in the case and to help the veteran locate and gather medical records, whether they're VA records or military records or private records and any other documentation from their service records. But the VA does a really poor job in most of those areas, particularly in the area of telling veterans what they actually need in order to prevail. Now, the VA will give them kind of checklist of sorts, but that's just general information. It really doesn't offer the veteran any real analysis of how those general rules apply to that veteran's situation to know, okay, well, where are the dots in my case that have to be connected? And these cases can be incredibly complicated. We have one case on appeal to the United States Court of Appeals with veterans' claims, but the record on appeal was over 8,000 pages. That's a lot of information. It's a lot for the VA to go through, but it's a lot for the veteran. A lot of it was medical records, but other evidence that had accumulated over the last more than four decades. He was a Vietnam veteran. But the point is, these cases are very complicated, and going through records is almost like looking sometimes for the needle in the proverbial haystack as far as what documents are really the key things that are needed to win. And again, the VA does a pretty weak job in helping the veteran connect those dots. Now, as you said earlier, the system originally was not designed to need lawyers. And I agree, that's the way it should be. Why should lawyers have to be involved? Our legal system is already complicated, and it shouldn't be that way for the veterans. But over the years, the body of law now, the general workbook that we have for just statutes and regulations is over 2,000 pages. And that's not 2,000 pages of large print. That's 2,000 pages of very small print, multiple columns on each page. And that's not counting even the VA's internal regulations on how they process claims or large body of appellate court decisions. So it's what that points to me is the need, which has been discussed for many years now, is to totally revamp the disability compensation program, which is, let's focus on what we're trying to do. We're trying to compensate the veteran for his or her disabilities that keep them from being able to work either at all or at least to the extent where they would have been able to work except for their military service. And then, with that goal in mind, figure out what's a fair and manageable way to create a set of rules and to evaluate those disabilities with that goal in mind. We're really far from that. In fact, over the years, the rules have just been, they add more and more. It's like any other government organization. Once they're created, they take on an existence of their own. And we've seen that. There's good intentions behind it, but it's gotten really out of hand. It's very, very complicated, and most of the people at the regional office, very few of them are lawyers. And we can tell you, I mean, my experience as a lawyer, I've been a lawyer for over 30 years, is that the regulations are very complex. They're not, for the most part, they're not written very clearly, which just leaves room for differing interpretations and more litigation, more appeals. It needs to be simplified. and that ought to be a primary goal. You don't hear really leadership of the VA discussing that, and you really don't hear people in Congress doing that either. So, all right, let's open the lines up again for callers. Go ahead, Richard.
When I was president of the Somerset County Bar in New Jersey, I implemented a couple of programs for settlement conferences and CLE classes, and they were all designed to streamline the process, to save the client money. For instance, on the settlement conferences, instead of having the lawyers show up in the courthouse and spend all day on a Monday, I proposed that they do them by phone. I didn't really make a lot of friends with my lawyer friends because you can imagine if you're sitting in court all day just reading the newspaper waiting for the court to call your case, you're getting paid while you're sitting there.
Right.
Versus a settlement conference by phone, and all you got to do is the court calls your case, calls you up, conferences you in, and you 15 minutes later you've had your conference instead of 8 hours later. So one of the things that has been kind of on my mind about this, using that as a kind of an example, is mediation. Now, I don't expect the VA to do a mediation program, but one of the things that they do say in their letters to us is they talk about contacting, the VA. Would you mind if we contacted you or your representative?
Right.
And of course, we say, of course not. Well, in the 4 or 5 years that we've been doing this and the hundreds of cases that we've been dealing with, I think I've only been contacted a half a dozen times. But the times I have been contacted, they've been very meaningful and very productive.
Right. And you mean contacted by phone before the formal hearing.
Yeah. And right. The thing is, though, it's the same person who's contacting me.
Right.
So she's doing a real good job, but the other 29 that work with her aren't taking her lead. But, getting back to that leadership thing you were talking about, it's a shame that there isn't somebody, a supervisor, seeing the results that this one DRO is having and saying to the other ones, hey, pick up the phone.
Right.
Call the lawyer. Call the representative. You might be able to work this thing out.
That's a great idea, and that's something that we found has worked well in the few cases where they've called us before the hearing, rather than just force us to wait for the hearing and then go from there. I think there needs to be a change in culture, a change of leadership in the VA, a reallocation of their resources, and they need to keep the focus on the fact that these veterans need help, and they can't wait so many years.
Yeah. David, one of the things that, to this day, the one question that I always pause before I answer, and I almost get like a pit in my stomach because I know what I've got to tell the veteran, but I hate to tell him, which is, how long is this going to take, Mr. Hurley?
Right.
Or what's the status of my case, Mr. Hurley, and the case has only been in the system for 6 or 8 months or a year. And I know what the answer is, but I still have a real tough time saying, well, unfortunately, Mr. Veteran, you're looking at another 2 years, 2.5 years. I mean, that's just awful. And I feel guilty about having to say that to these people. Why doesn't the VA feel just as guilty?
Right. Well, I don't think they do. There's really been no improvement since Bob McDonnell took over as the secretary 2.5 years ago. There's been no noticeable improvement in their appeal processing. And, the VA talks the story that they're doing that, and we've not seen it at all, nor at the BVA, the Board of Veterans Appeals level in Washington, where we're still waiting years to get hearings. And then even after the hearing, sometimes waiting 6 months or a year to get a decision. So we're going to be one of the things that we're going to be doing in the upcoming weeks and months on this show is to discuss and analyze what's really going on with the VA as the new administration takes over and starts implementing their ideas, and also what is Congress doing? What can veterans groups be doing? So I encourage listeners out there, whether you're a veteran or a family member of a veteran, or perhaps if you work for the VA itself and you like to share your experiences, It seems like really the only thing we get from the VA that we think is the full story is the occasional whistleblower, either that goes to Congress or goes to the media. And, Richard, you and I know of some cases of whistleblowers out of the St. Pete regional office, but other regional offices as well as medical centers, which there was some whistleblowers that were calling out the VA on the waiting time scandal and the falsification of statistics scandal. So there needs to be people within the VA that are willing to take the risk, be a whistleblower, report what they know, make changes, and have the protection of the law and the politicians in those efforts.
Speaking of that whistleblower down in St. Pete, David, if you recall, he testified in Congress in 2014, and one of the things he said was regarding the claims, he was told by his supervisor that we don't, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, he was told, we don't mind eventually paying the veteran, but we're going to make sure that he works for it.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know? That's immoral. That's unethical. These people have served their country. And we could tell you, we could share with listeners all sorts of really heartbreaking stories of veterans from across the generations, but including from the most recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And these are young men and women that went over in their late teens or 20s, and particularly those that were infantry that saw a lot of close combat. But in the nature of those wars, pretty much everyone is a target with IEDs and other weapons. They come back with significant, whether it's traumatic brain injury, whether they come back missing limbs, and certainly the psychological impact. And so the whole culture of the VA needs to change about that. There are a lot of good people in the VA, but as an organization, you'd have to say it's pretty dysfunctional, because this waiting time has been going on for years. And I'm talking about the claim side. It's been going on for decades, even. And there's really been no appreciable, successful programs. The VA has come up with occasionally some ideas to chip away at the edges. About 5 or 6 years ago, they came up with this, what they call the fully developed claim program. Fully developed claim meaning that if the veteran and the veteran's representative, which is typically not a lawyer, a veteran service officer from some veterans group, they put together their claim and whatever records, and then tell the VA, go ahead and make a decision with what we've sent in, because we don't need the VA to do anything further. The VA says on their own instruction, this is not risky to you. But I think that's really not the case at all, because you're then relying simply on your own view of what's going to be enough to satisfy the VA, and the VA's guidance is pretty vague to begin with. And then what happens? So they may service-connect some of the disabilities. They may say others are not service-connected. But even worse, they tend to lowball ratings. So the veteran may be suffering severe post-traumatic stress disorder, have severe orthopedic injuries or traumatic brain injury, and really not be able to work and not function. We've heard a lot of stories from our clients and their family members about what it's like, to see and live with someone who went over to Iraq and Afghanistan, a very healthy young man or young woman, and come back totally non-functioning. They don't leave their room. They can't hold a job. They may be addicted to drugs or alcohol, and they're not really getting the help on the healthcare side either for any of those things. They're getting some, but they may be waiting a long time for it, and the VA's help on the psychiatric is too much as far as pushing the pills and not some of the other therapies that are out there. But my point being, there's a lot of room for some improvement, and let me give the number out again for our listeners to call in if they'd like to share their experiences. Again, toll-free number 1-888-627-6008, 1-888-627-6008. So, Richard, what are some of your thoughts or your advice, just in general, for listeners while they're waiting these long periods of time for their claims to be decided, their appeals? What can they be doing?
Well, one of the things that they should be doing is gathering as much of their medical evidence as possible. Get your medical file, contact family and friends. Maybe they can help write a statement as to what their conditions are. Write your own statement. The other thing that I think people should realize is that you need to open your mail. And veterans, they receive mail from the VA, and they're so gun shy that they tend to put that mail up on the mantle and hope it goes away, rather than opening it, because if they don't open it, it's very possible that they could be missing a very important deadline. David,
right.
You and I have seen this quite a bit. And, it's kind of ironic. The VA doesn't have a deadline to resolve these claims, but God forbid a veteran misses his deadline and his case could be closed on him.
Right.
So, make sure you open those that mail. And if you do have a representative, an attorney, make sure that your attorney or representative sees that. Don't assume that just because it says on the second page of the letter that it was copied to your attorney, Richard Hurley, that it was in fact sent to Mr. Hurley. Make sure you call Mr. Hurley and say, hey, did you get a copy of this letter that I just received?
Right.
And get that letter over to him. David, there is some good news that we should, I know we're spending the last 47 minutes dumping on the VA. And,
all right.
We are trying to, throughout the year, hopefully we'll see some progress. But there is some good news, and maybe you can tell our listeners what's going on with Camp Lejeune.
Well, that's a good issue, and I'd like to devote one of our upcoming shows just to that issue. Many of you that were in the Marine Corps stationed at Camp Lejeune may have already heard of this situation in which over decades, from the 50s into the 80s, there was significant groundwater contamination at Camp Lejeune and Marine Corps Air Station New River in North Carolina. And just this past Friday the 13th, the VA finally published their final rule in the Code of Federal Regulations in the Federal Register, which will amend the Code of Federal Regulations effective March the 14th, which adds 8 presumptive conditions. So if a Marine who has served for at least 30 cumulative days, I say cumulative because that's total, they don't have to be consecutive. So if a veteran was there for a couple weeks, one point left and came back, anywhere between August of 1953 through December of 1987, and they were discharged from the military under conditions other than dishonorable, and I know that there's a whole bucket of worms there we could analyze, but those 8 conditions are the following: adult leukemia, aplastic anemia, bladder cancer, kidney cancer, liver cancer, multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and Parkinson's disease. And you could be a veteran from the active duty, a reservist, or a member of the Guard, but if you served at least 30 cumulative days between August of 53 and December 87, and God forbid you develop one of these 8 conditions, disabilities or diseases, the VA will presume that it was due to your exposure to this toxic water that they had at Camp Lejeune. Now, the interesting thing is that presumption is rebuttable, and we're kind of in new territory here. We've had similar things with Agent Orange over the years, and the VA only would very rarely try to rebut the presumption there. But we'll have to see how this develops with the Camp Lejeune.
David, getting into that rebuttable presumption issue, I've gone online and I've checked what's been coming out of the VA, and they're saying, and I quote, "But now veterans with 8 conditions would have presumptive service connection, meaning they will no longer have to fight for their benefits." Well, that's not really true, is it?
Well, it's not a precise explanation of the law, when the law reads that it's essentially a rebuttable presumption. But like I say, we'll have to see. Time will tell with actual cases how aggressive or how tough the VA is in either trying to rebut these presumptions or just sitting back and allowing these presumptions to go unchallenged, basically. So the example would be, let's say that a Camp Lejeune veteran developed bladder cancer. Okay, the presumption now will be that that bladder cancer should be service-connected because of that veteran's service at Camp Lejeune, assuming he or she served for at least 30 days. Now, how might it be rebutted? If some doctor says, well, that presumption is fine, but in this particular veteran's case, in reviewing this veteran's health, medical issues over the intervening decades, that perhaps a doctor might say that that bladder cancer is more likely due to, let's say, smoking or some other reason that is not, or that perhaps is secondary to some other cancer which clearly is not on the list. So that's how the presumption might get rebutted. We'll have to see. It might become case-specific. What we found by comparison on the Agent Orange side, Agent Orange, the defoliant used in Vietnam, is that the VA has not really been aggressive in trying to rebut that. And it's actually been quite a very, very generous, the Agent Oranges, in other words, the Agent Orange presumptions have been very generous in the sense that some of the conditions for Agent Orange, the cases that we've seen, have included ischemic heart disease and prostate cancer and type 2 diabetes, as well as various other kinds of cancers, that the VA is not trying to rebut those. And as we all know, that many of the Vietnam veterans are now at an age that they're kind of primed for those disabilities in any event. So we'll have to see. I think that the Camp Lejeune, it is good news, as you said, that the VA has finally, after years of battling this. Now, a question that I'd like to devote a further show to is this. Camp Lejeune is one of literally hundreds of military installations that have had environmental issues. When I was on active duty, one of my many active duty assignments was in North Carolina, and I had to wear, as the JAG officer, as the second in charge of that office, I also had to wear the hat of the environmental lawyer at that base, which was in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And like many bases, that base, which is called Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, had been built, you know, back around World War II, before World War II, and back when environmental laws were not essentially non-existent. And so they were spending, by the 1980s and 90s, I was there in the early 90s, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a year just on doing studies of the polluted soil and contaminated underground water and the water plumes and digging up the leaking underground storage tanks and burn pits, et cetera. So it's a common problem at many installations. And what will be interesting to see is how widespread the Camp Lejeune phenomenon then becomes to other installations. And I'm not saying every installation is that bad, but there are certainly some installations that I think many people knowledgeable about the environmental history of those bases would say they're even far worse than Camp Lejeune. So that's probably, you know, a really good topic for one of our upcoming shows, and I'd certainly welcome to hear from veterans. Now, I know we're rapidly running out of town here. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell our listeners, any of them who did serve at Camp Lejeune during 1953 to 1987, if you're going to run off to your lawyer or your representative and say, hey, I understand that the Camp Lejeune thing's been resolved, file my claim. As I understand reading the regulation, that there's a 60-day grace period, so that so the effective date would be sometime in March, around March 13th.
Yes, March 14th is the date.
March 14th.
That's a good point, and it's a very the Federal Register notice that came out is very detailed as far as the VA explaining their rationale, and it's a lot of fodder for analysis by veterans and veterans groups. So a lot of things we can discuss in future weeks. So I'd like to thank everyone for listening tonight. our very first show here on BBS Radio. And as you know, this Veterans News Hour will be here every week, Monday evenings, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. You can listen to our show here. You can also visit our show webpage here, bbsradio.com/the Veterans News Hour. And we certainly want to thank our producer, BBS Radio, Doug Newsom, for the great job he's done for us. And we invite all listeners to become show sponsors and advertisers. You can contact me, David Corey, at 813-662-0760, 813-662-0760, or via email, which is available on the show's website. If you're interested in becoming a show sponsor, advertiser, or a guest on the show, we're always looking for guests to appear. So thanks again, and please tune in next week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.